There's one brief moment from the end of part one that I neglected this morning, and I do want to just draw your attention to it. Comes at the end of part nine, very end of part nine, heading into that crucial part 10 that was unfortunately heavily censored, so we don't have the fullness of it. But final paragraph of part 9. Here's the quotation. He's talking about that utopian crystal palace they're trying to build, this perfect world where everything will be ideal. And he says, I know, for instance, that suffering is inadmissible in light stage plays. In the utopian crystal palace, it'd be inconceivable, for suffering means doubt and denial. And what kind of crystal palace would that be if people had doubts about it? Nevertheless, I'm certain that man will never give up true suffering. That is chaos and destruction. Why, suffering is the only cause of consciousness. Dostoevsky obviously would go beyond that and have a greater purpose for suffering, but that, again, it's a small insight on the part of this man who does occasionally have glimmers of truth, and that sense that suffering can never be done away with, will always be there, is pure Dostoevsky. Now, just so we have some sense of where we are, part one is 1864, okay? Our hero, we learn then, is 40 years old. Part two is 1848. So that at the time that he's reminiscing back about that, he would have been 24, is that right? Minus six, yeah, 24 years old. Would have been a young man. So that's what's happening. We get a slightly different, we get a change in tone and style. That ranting that characterized part one, that incessant voice that just keeps coming at us through part one, begins to change a bit. He's going to tell us some memories from his youth. He's going back in time, and as he does so, the tone at first becomes lighter. We have some moments of burlesque. We get some moments of burlesque. And we also get some caricature. He's able to do that. There's a little more variety in part two, and then the storm clouds move in, and it becomes extraordinarily dark. Dostoevsky saw that and deliberately makes this movement from one period to the other, in that what he believed, he gives us the man at present time and then goes back in time and is showing us how the mistaken notions of the present time, 1864, the 1860s, were caused by mistaken ideas from an earlier time. There were a set of bad ideas here that led to the really horrible ideas that we just heard spouted in what would have then been the present time. And if these awful ideas, and it's really just that simple list I ran through before, complete reliance on reason, absolute determinism, and the building of a utopian social paradise, those phony ideas eventually, according to Dostoevsky, lead inevitably to nihilism, just nothingness. You cannot turn man into a machine. He will rail against it. But if you try to do all that, you're going to end up with nothing. Just nothing. You're going to end up with nihilistic figures, and they will populate the later novels. He will give a sense of that. These horrible figures who have come to believe in nothing because everything's been rejected. This is untenable. This has been rejected. But he blamed the previous generation for this madness. And here we see our anti-hero as a young man, and his head at that point is filled with the nonsense from an earlier generation. Let me just quote Joseph Frank, Dostoevsky's biographer, who said that the 1840s fostered a kind of egoism and vanity which allowed superfluous men of the gentry and liberal intelligentsia to live in a dream world of universal beneficence while neglecting the simplest and most obvious moral obligations. And the key to what we've got here is romantic idealism, a phony vision, and it's a wonderful phrase, universal beneficence. This romantic idealism that was going to create a wonderful, happy world simply because we were all going to love each other. You know, we could draw a line from that first Woodstock, the flowers and peace and all of that stuff, to the throwing of the bottles and the burning of the cars. That is the same progress. This phony, gooey, sentimental romanticism, peace and love, man, okay? The love beads and the long hair, the flowers every, you know, if you go to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair, okay? All of that nonsense is untenable. It's a lie. It is a false vision. And what it leads to, because of its falsity, is either mechanical robots or raging insane personalities who are filled with fury and want to destroy everything. Okay? One leads to the other. And that's the point that's being made here in the novel, but we're getting it backwards. He's showing us the results and now going back to the causes. Let me state it this way. This might be an easier way to think of it. There was this huge, overwhelming, abstract love of humanity. I love the whole world. I love everyone in it. I want to do wonderful things for the whole world. Get out of my way. No room for individual people. Excuse me, I'm too busy loving all of humanity. You stink. You're unpleasant. I want nothing to do with you. But I love all of humanity, and that's the problem, okay? It is much easier to love humanity in the abstract than to perform individual concrete acts of charity to real flesh and blood who can often be troubling and annoying. And that's what we're going to find going on in part two. Our anti-hero in part two is filled with vanity, okay? He is of his age. He is filled with vanity. He is filled with egoism. He is absolutely convinced that he is special. He is unique. He's smarter than everyone around him, and therefore he looks down on those people that he works among and that he lives among, because he's better than they are. I'm in the first section of part two. I'm on page 125 here. It's about the third or fourth paragraph. And he's talking about the people that he worked with at his office. Okay, again, it's just an office. It's this meaningless job. I, of course, loathed and despised everyone in my office, although I was afraid of them at the same time. At times, I even considered them above me. I kept shifting from one extreme to the other for no apparent reason. One day, I'd despise them. The next I'd feel they were my betters. This shifting back and forth actually does make sense in this way. He is filled with vanity. He is filled with ego, and therefore he has to look down on them because he knows he's better than they are. But in order to keep this idea going that he's better than they are, he needs their attention and their approval because it's the only world he's got. So that he has to have some reaction from them. He's dependent on them. How can he know how wonderful he is if they don't tell him how wonderful he is? because he's got nothing else to tell him how wonderful he is. And after a while, Dostoevsky knew, you get tired of telling yourself, I'm so wonderful, I'm so wonderful, I'm so wonderful. And you say, don't you agree? Don't you agree that I'm wonderful? Won't you tell me that I'm wonderful? Please recognize my wonderfulness. And we are social creatures. We're dependent on others. So that what happens, he can be superior and despise everyone, but he expects that superiority to be recognized in the world around him. And the world around him is completely indifferent to him. Which means he hates them because they won't recognize how wonderful he is. He's dependent on them for that recognition. And that means that he is dependent on them and he loathes himself because he's dependent on these people he despises, but he's dependent on them because they have to convince him that he is so wonderful. It's just a psychological mess. Absolute mess, okay? Let me state something very simply. This vanity, this sense of superiority, absolutely destroys any capacity for real social union. Okay? There's no way he can ever be connected with these people in the world around him because he's so much better than they are. And at the same time, he is desperate for some sort of social connection. It is very clear that as time has gone on, this has caused a huge problem for him because he needs to connect. He needs to find people in the world to connect with. I am still in the first part. I am about halfway, a little over a third of the way through part one. He talks about vices he would engage in at night. He says he's going to be absolutely true here. Once passing by a tavern, I saw some men fighting with billiard cues through a lighted window. One of them, this is page 129, one of them was tossed out of the window. At another time, a scene like that would have made me sick. But this time, I envied that ejected gentleman so much that I entered the tavern and stepped into the billiard room thinking, maybe I could pick a fight too and be thrown out of the window. He is so desperate for some recognition that he exists, he'll be willing to pick a fight and maybe someone will throw him out the window. As a matter of fact, I wasn't drunk. That's how far despair can drive a man. But nothing came of it. I couldn't even manage to be tossed out of a window, and I left without picking a fight. And again, what? He's a failure. He's a failure. And he knows that he is a failure. And it has its effect on him, okay? We get the absolute crazy game he plays of chicken with that officer, okay? Walking down on it's Nevsky Avenue every day, knowing the officer will come and hoping he will drive the officer out of his way, but every day he's the one who steps aside. And he hates himself for, I mean, this is what social contact has come to in his world. A game of chicken with a man he doesn't even know very well. And what is that contact? Walking down the street, straight at him. He'll step aside. No, I've got to step aside. Oh, I'm so low. I'm nothing. It's absolute pathetic. But see what it is. It is egoism run amok. It is vanity collapsing into self-loathing. Okay? And we're just here at the beginnings of the problems that will create this monster. But we see them developing. There is no way he can possibly connect with this world around him. He has lost any capacity for simple, direct human feelings. He cannot connect in ordinary ways with ordinary human beings. But at the same time, he is filled with these grandiose schemes for changing the world. Now, this is just... this is near the beginning of section two in part two, okay? Page 137 here, it's about paragraph four. But how much love, how much I experienced in my dreams when I escaped to the sublime and the beautiful. It's just filled with romantic nonsense. Dostoevsky knew that. He had been filled with it, reading his Schiller, reading his Hugo, okay? Perhaps it was an imaginary love, and maybe it was never directed toward another human being, but it was such an overflowing love that there was no need to direct it. That would have been an unnecessary luxury. It was such a great love, it didn't really need an object. It was just overflowing love going everywhere. Everything always ended safely in a leisurely, rapturous sliding into the domain of art. That is, into the beautiful lives of heroes, stolen from the authors of novels and poems, and adapted to the demands of the moment, whatever they might be. I, for instance, triumph over everyone, and they, of course, are strewn in the dust, acknowledging my superiority. I'm all forgiving. I'm a great poet and court chamberlain. I fall in love. I inherit millions and donate them to human causes and take advantage of this opportunity to publicly confess my backslidings and disgrace, which of course is no ordinary disgrace, but contains much that is sublime and beautiful in it, something in the Manfred style, the hero of Byron, the long poem by Byron. Everyone is weeping and kissing me. They could hardly be so thick-skinned as not to. Then I leave, hungry and barefoot, to preach new ideas and rout the reactionaries at Austerlitz. Then a triumphal march is played, an amnesty is declared. The Pope agrees to leave Rome for Brazil. There's a ball for all of Italy at the Villa Borghese on the shores of Lake Como, which lake, for this occasion, is moved to the vicinity of Rome. Then there's a scene in the bushes, and so on and so forth. See what I mean? This is what's going through his head, okay? There is absolutely schemes for transforming the whole world, even physically. We'll move Lake Como down near Rome if I want it, okay? But it's all up here. It's all up here. And as all this is going on up here, there is less and less contact with real human beings. But they're grand schemes, and when he gets his millions, he will donate them to good causes. The man is a mess. What can you say? Romanticism has ruined him and made him incapable of functioning in the real world. And how do we finally see it? I'm not going to go into this scene. I think it's self-evident if you've got that background, where he demands to go to the party with his friends. Okay? He does have a few friends. He insists on being made part of this social event, even though they seem to be reluctant because they're aware of the kind of fellow he is. And sure enough, when he gets there, he cannot function with anyone. The vanity keeps coming forward, and then the self-loathing. And we're just switching back and forth all the time. The fact of the matter is, he keeps saying his friends are stupid and pedestrian, and they prove themselves to be. They clearly do. They're not as crazy as he is, but they're not as interesting as he is. They obviously haven't tapped into all of this, and for all of his flaws and all of his problems, he is a more interesting personality, but they won't acknowledge him because he is a bull in the china shop. You can't have the man around. You all have friends like that, okay? You kind of like them, you feel obligated to them, and yet you get them around and they're just awful. You don't want to deal with them. They'll ruin any social engagement. They're just horrible, okay? He's one of them. And it descends to, it's, I think, one of the funniest moments in all literature, where he insists on just making his presence felt by stamping back and forth in the room. And we find out he does it for hours! Just, he says, I was getting very tired. It really was it. But he just insists on stamping. It is the spoiled brat lying on the floor, kicking and screaming and holding his breath till his face turns blue in order to get attention. And that's what we have here. We have the egoism and vanity of a little child. But there is some small degree of innocence here that's about to be lost. And I'm going to shift. I want to just the final remarks looking at this sudden, huge shift in tone. There is a kind of vulnerability in our hero. He's a mess, but he is vulnerable. He follows his friends to the house of ill repute. And part of it, again, is just to go along, to be with them. He gets there, and something disastrous happens. He meets a soul that is more vulnerable than himself. For all of his vanity and all of his egoism, he is dependent. And that dependence is somehow this crying need to be recognized by other human beings. What is it? It's very simple. It is a need to be loved. And Dostoevsky understood that that urge, that need, was very real. And then he comes upon Lisa, who needs it even more. A soul more vulnerable than his own. And we have, in this connection, the beginning of this one potential relationship that defines the whole end of the book. Now, I can state it very simply. It is a soul and a brain clogged with romanticism that claims to love all of humanity and wants to do the best for all of humanity, that is desperate for human contact, that goes to the house of ill repute to pay for a little human connection, and encounters a soul more vulnerable who also needs love, and there is the potential there for a real flesh and blood relationship between two vulnerable human beings who see for an instant something in each other, and there is the potential out of that love for something good to happen. I've got to say here that this final episode is also a parody not just of that novel, but also of a tradition in 19th century European literature that shows up over and over and over again, and that is the good, noble man who saves the young prostitute. That out of his nobility and generosity, he drags her up out of the gutter in which she exists and turns her life around and makes her a wonderful, loving, moral human being. Dostoevsky had had enough of it. And he realized that that was also phony romanticism. So what he creates here is a situation where a real flesh and blood, albeit nuts, human male encounters a real flesh and blood beaten down human female with the potential for real love and particularly a chance for redemption of the male by a loving heart, a genuine female loving heart. In spite of everything that goes on, it is clear that this woman sees something decent in this man and wants to help him. It is a reversal, if you will, of all these other phony scenes that had permeated all of Western European literature, even Russian literature. Tolstoy's last novel called Resurrection plays that same pattern, the exact same pattern. The noble man who reaches down in the gutter and brings up the young prostitute and saves her. Dostoevsky turns it around. He makes it real, and the one who has the loving heart, the one who is really suffering, the one who offers the possibility of that that human connection, genuine charity that could save this guy, is the woman. Is the woman. Let's just look at his attitude towards the beginning. I'm at page 169. They're having their first conversation, okay? And it's been going on for some time. This is in section 6. Of part 2, again about a third of the way through the chapter, page 169. Pay no attention to me, I'm here myself, so I can't tell you what to do. Maybe I'm worse than you, I said hurriedly, to justify myself. But then, it's different for a man. For although I may defile and degrade myself, I'm still no one's slave. I come and go. I'm not stuck here. I brush it off, and I'm another man. But you, you're a slave from the very beginning. And we get the sense right away that he has finally found someone he can exert power over. There is finally someone he can feel superior to. There is finally someone that he can tweak and move around. If you will, there's finally someone he can bump off the sidewalk. He has found a soul that is more vulnerable. And at the same time, we get the sense that there is something good here because he opens up with little moments of honesty that are unlike anything we've heard from him before. Very next page, it's just about a page and a half, a little over a page and a half later. Bottom of 170 here. Let me tell you something about myself. You know, Lisa, if I had had a family when I was a child, I'd have turned out quite different from what I am today. I've given it a lot of thought. However bad things may be within a family, I still say that a father and mother are part of you, not your enemies or just strangers. Be it only once a year, they'll still show you their love. Whatever else, you still have the feeling that it is your home. But I grew up without a family, and that's why I'm like this, you know, without feelings. Whew! That's a tone we've not heard before. That's a little glimpse into where this man comes from, about the only one we get in the whole novel. He never says anything like that otherwise. Why is he opened up? Because there's someone who cares who is listening. And it is a little moment of honest self-analysis. I waited for a while. I didn't think she understood. And anyway, I was being ridiculous with this moralizing stuff, and he immediately undercuts it. He immediately has to undercut it. He then goes on, if I'd been a father, I think I'd have loved my daughters more than my sons. What's that got to do with it, she asked. So she was listening. Nothing really. And then he begins pontificating. After that little honest moment, he starts puffing himself up, and he's making long speeches, and she suddenly responds in the midst of this, spouting about, you know, again, large general ideas. She suddenly says, but there are people who are willing to sell their daughters, let alone allow them to marry decently, she suddenly declared. So that was it. And she responds with an honest, somehow a decent marriage was forbidden her, and she was sold instead. We have an awful sense of why she's here. There has been a moment of an honest exchange. There's been the beginning again of the possibility of a relationship. So that was it. But instead of responding in sympathy, that, Lisa, happens in those wretched families where there's no God and no love. Right, but I went on zestfully. And where there is no love, there's no reason either. It's true that such families exist, but I wasn't speaking of them. It looks as though you were never happy in your family. That's what makes you say things like that. You seem to be truly unhappy. Well, poverty has a lot to do with it. And suddenly he's spouting typical social liberal crap. Can't respond one-on-one. Can't talk about her as an actual flesh and blood human being in an actual difficult situation. No, you're for, well, of course, but the problem is you're poor. And once we can conquer poverty in the world, once poverty is taken care of, then there will be no more suffering such as you are enduring, and people will embrace each other, and we'll all go to Woodstock and sing Kumbaya together. And of course, it's absolute crap. And what is he doing? He is scared off. He is scared off. And he will not allow himself to be vulnerable and open at this moment. So the vanity rears up again. The vanity rears up. And Dostoevsky is making very clear, a love of all mankind is a way of avoiding contact with individual human beings. Because that's what's going on at this very instant, and there we see it very clearly. He keeps spouting. He spouts for pages, and then there's another embarrassing silence. And she says, "Why you?" She started. This is the very end of section six. Very end of section six, part two. Why, you, she started, but she cut herself off. But I understood. There was something different in her voice, some new quiver. It was no longer harsh, coarse, and resigned, but soft, shy, and ashamed, so that I myself felt ashamed and guilty. And he thinks, oh, maybe she doesn't respond to my wonderful words. Maybe something good is happening. What, I asked with tender curiosity, why you're just like a book. You read all that somewhere, didn't you? You put all that stuff in your head, you read that, and now you just spout it. Why, it's like listening to a psychology sociological textbook. She said, and I thought I caught a sarcastic note in her voice again. That pinched me painfully. It wasn't what I was expecting. He thought she'd fall down at his feet and say, you're so wise, you're so brilliant, you love all humanity, you're what I've been seeking all... No, I didn't understand that sarcasm is a scream, the last refuge of shy, pure persons against those who rudely and insistently try to break into their hearts. He generalizes. Generalizes, okay? How do I fit this into Psychology 101? All right, let's see. This sort of person does this. And again, she simply becomes an example. Until the last moment, her pride prevented her from saying openly what she felt. I should have guessed that. If only from the timid hesitation she had to overcome to make her defensive, sarcastic remark. But I didn't understand, and a nasty feeling pervaded me. Wait, I said to myself, I'll show you. And he comes back, and he responds with an attack, okay? He responds with an attack and drives her into the ground. I'm not going to go through it. It is too painful. But basically says, you're going to become old and ugly and you'll die and no one will care and no one will come to your funeral and you're just... it is unbelievably horrific. But one line. It'd be lucky for you, Lisa, if you died quickly of consumption in some basement, like the woman in the coffin I told you about. You mentioned the hospital, you'd be lucky if they took you there. He rails like this for pages. What's he doing? Power game, crushing her, because she dared to put a pin into his phony dream. And he just lashes back and savages her, absolutely savages her. He finishes, and she has a human reaction. She collapses. The fact is, I'd never witnessed such despair. Well, what did he think the reaction was going to be? She lay prone on the bed, her arms around the pillow, and her face buried in it. Her breast was heaving spasmodically, and all her young body was writhing. The sobs compressed in her chest were choking her as they tried to break out. Then suddenly they broke through in horrifying wails as she clasped the pillow even harder, not wanting anyone alive to see her tears and her suffering. This is real suffering, and he is the cause of it. She bit the pillow, bit her hand till she drew blood. I saw it later. Then clutched at her tangled hair with her fingers, holding her breath and clenching her teeth. I wanted to say something to her, soothe her, but I didn't dare. Because by soothing her, he'd give up the power. And the power is more important. Ego is more important. His selfishness is more important than a moment of connection again. But finally he says, "Forgive me, Lisa. I shouldn't have," I began, but her fingers clutched my hands so hard that I realized I was saying the wrong thing, stopped, and said instead, "Here's my address, Lisa, come and see me." Well, he's mistaken. She's clutching him because she needs him. He's starting to say the right thing. He's asking for forgiveness. He says, "I shouldn't have," but he's weakening. Oh, well, I shouldn't say that, so I'll just get out of here. But he can't let her go. Why? There's something real. There is a real human connection. He's never known one before, as far as we can tell. He gives the address. "I'll come," she whispered determinedly without raising her head. "And now I have to go. Goodbye. See you soon." He's out of there. It's more than he could handle. He spends days waiting for her to come. She obsesses him. Why? It's real. She's human. She seems to care for him. He actually now has experience an actual relationship with another human being, during which he behaved like a pig much of the time. But it's the only human contact we have seen this man have in the entire novel. And please notice where it's coming, right at the end. Again, part of the reason for this structure. Suddenly there is a real human relationship. It's the only one we get in the whole book. And it's coming right indeed at the very end of the book, okay? I'm going to do this quickly. I'm not going to go on much longer. I think the point has been made. I want to get to the very end, but let me say this. Before the ending occurs, we get that very odd scene with Apollon, his servant. The servant who absolutely and completely rules in the household. We get in his house total inversion. The servant is master. The servant is in charge. He is terrified of his servant. This is the man who said earlier in part two, I am no one's slave. And then we find out he is browbeaten by his own servant, is incapable of saying anything to his own servant, and lives in fear of his own servant. And what we have again is a whole sense, a series of power plays. Who's in charge, who's got the power, and the notion that everything is inverted. But we get this curious, sick relationship with the servant right before Lisa reappears. And we get the sense of, again, of a man who is brutalized, driven down, huge ego, but the ego keeps being crushed to the point where he can't even stand up to his own servant. She shows up. The servant says, oh, there's somebody to see you. She comes in, beginning of section 9. I'm on page 192. And the thing he feared most happens. She's come to his place, and it's crummy and run down, and he looks awful. I stood in front of her. By the way, notice Dostoevsky quotes ironically from a popular romantic poem of the period. Boldly and freely enter my house to be its mistress, my sweet spouse. We have this poor, pathetic prostitute coming to see this desperately crazy, sick man, okay? This is reality. This is human. This is human life. I stood in front of her, crushed, branded, sordidly overcome with shame, and I think I smiled, trying to close my ragged, stuffing-shedding old dressing gown. It had all happened exactly as I'd imagined it in my moments of depression. Apollon, having had his fill of looking at us, left the room. But that didn't make me feel any better. Worse yet, she too suddenly became more embarrassed than I could have imagined, and it was looking at me that embarrassed her. That's not the source of the embarrassment. She doesn't care how he's dressed, where he lives. The embarrassment comes from what happened the last time they were together. He has no clue. Sit down, I said mechanically, offering her the chair by the desk, while I installed myself on the sofa. She sat down, never taking her eyes off me. It looked as if she expected me to do something. And this naive expectation brought back my fury, but I controlled myself. She should have known better, pretending she hadn't noticed anything, but all was as usual, but instead she, and I felt, though still very vaguely, that I'd make her pay dearly for everything. For what? For his own shame. His own shame. And he thinks it's the shame of what? Poverty. And suddenly we realize he's living in real poverty. That doesn't matter. But he's going to make her pay for his shame. Okay? We begin the conversation. This is almost too painful to go through. He begins crushing her again. He begins haranguing again. We get, Dostoevsky understood something, that human relationships often proceed in cycles, same patterns, over and over again. And we get something of a very similar pattern. But again in the midst of it, we have moments when he himself will utter some truths. Top of page 197. He's been ranting at her. He has wept in front of her and says, you know, I'll never forgive you for these tears I couldn't hold back in front of you. Okay? I was like a stupid woman put to shame. And I'm confessing all this to you now so that I'll never forgive you. Yes, you and you alone are responsible for everything because you happen to be at hand, because I'm a louse, because I'm the most disgusting, most laughable, pettiest, most stupid, and most envious of all the worms on earth, which are in no way better than me, but which, hell knows why, never feel embarrassed. But me, all my life, I've let all sorts of scum push me around. That's just like me. And you think I care if you don't understand all this? What concern of mine are you? What concern is of mine whether or not you rot in that house? Don't you realize that when I finish telling you all this, I'll hate you just because you were here and listened to me? Why, a man only bears his soul like this once in a lifetime, and even then, only when he's in hysterics. What more do you want? Why do you still stay here after all this? Why are you pestering me? Why don't you leave? It's horrible, but in the hysterics, some truth comes out. He will speak truth to her again, but at this point, a very strange thing happened. I was so used to imagining everything happening the way it does in books and visualizing things falling somehow into the shape of my old daydreams that at first I didn't understand what was going on. What actually happened was that Lisa, whom I had humiliated and crushed, understood much more than I had thought. Out of all I had said, she had understood what a sincerely loving woman would understand first, that I myself was unhappy. Her concern is not selfish, vain, or egotistical. Her first concern is this man. It is an act of selflessness, and it is an act of love. He keeps shrieking at her. The more he realizes this, the more he shrieks at her. He can't bear it. He can't bear love. Why are you pestering me? Why don't you? Instead, she was concerned over the pain it must have caused me to say all that. And then, the poor thing had been so humiliated before and felt so much my inferior that it was beyond her to be angry or take offense. He's twisting it again. It's just she's so inferior to me. Suddenly she was standing and in an irresistible impulse with her whole being drawn toward me, but too shy to take a step forward, she stretched out her hands to me. It is a gesture of love. I couldn't stand it any longer. Then she flung her arms around my neck and burst into tears, and I too lost all control and sobbed as I never had in my life before, and the two pathetic souls weep together. They don't let me. I can't be good, I mumbled, stumbling to the couch. I threw myself on it, face down, and remained like that for at least a quarter of an hour, sobbing hysterically. She knelt near me, put her arms around my shoulders, and froze in this embrace. She holds him while he cries his heart out. But the trouble was that these hysterics couldn't go on forever. And so, for I'm writing down the truth in all its disgusting ugliness, as I lay on that couch of mine with my face buried in the greasy oilcloth cushion, I begin to realize at first distantly that it would be terribly awkward for me to lift my head now and look Lisa in the eyes. He's embarrassed. He's ashamed. I'm not sure what I was ashamed of, but I was ashamed all right. The thought also flashed through the turmoil in my head that we had definitely changed places, Lisa and I, that she now had the heroic role, and I was the beaten-down, crushed creature she had been that night over there. Psychology 101. Oh, now I'm playing this role, and she's playing that. We're not human beings. We're playing roles. This is role she's not playing. This is role reversal. And we can learn when we study role reversal techniques that this is what happens. And it is psychological crap. It is making a science out of human relationships. All this occurred to me while I was still lying face down on my couch. Good God, was it possible that I envied her? Yes, because she can love. Yes, because she possesses human charity. Yes, because she can put another human being before herself. I can't answer that to this day, and then, of course, I understand even less than I do now. I cannot live without having someone to bully and order around. But since nothing can be explained by reasoning, why reason? And now we toss away reason completely. Anyway, I managed to overcome my feelings, and since I had to raise my head sooner or later, I raised it. And to this day, I'm sure that precisely because I was ashamed to look in her eye, new feeling flashed in my heart, the need to dominate and possess. Passion burned in my eyes as I fiercely clasped her hands. Ah, how I hated her, and how furiously I was drawn to her at that moment. I won't go on. He performs a brute male act on her in order to destroy love. And it is a power game. And he crushes her again. It is absolutely horrible. Section 10, he explains why he could never fall in love anyway. This is his way of ending the relationship. And then he just wants her out of there. He just wants her gone. Because, of course, she is a reminder of what he's lost, destroyed, would not allow to come into his life or into his home. I wanted peace. I wanted to be left alone in my mouse hole. Now we know where we found him. He's still there, years later. He's still alone, years later. A couple of minutes later, she emerged from behind the screen, looking fixedly at me. I grinned viciously. Although, in fact, I forced myself to grin like that for appearance's sake, but I had to turn away from her stare. Goodbye, she said, walking toward the door. She knows what's happened. She's leaving. I rushed after her, caught her hand, opened it, slipped something in, then closed it again. Then I turned away, tore over to the opposite corner of the room so I wouldn't see, at least. It is the ultimate insult he pays her. And as she leaves, he reduces her to what she was when they first met, meaning he does not have to deal with love. Life is sheer materialism. It was a business transaction. She goes. I return to my room deep in thought. I felt terribly sad. Vanity, egoism, not a thought about her. I stopped by the desk near the chair on which she had sat and stared blankly in front of me. A minute passed, and suddenly I saw on the table right in front of my eyes. Well, in short, I saw the crumpled 5-ruble bill I had pushed into her hand. It was that bill. She will not have it. It is not business. And she leaves the money behind. Where is she going? Why am I running after her? He goes dashing out looking for her. To go down on my knees before her, to sob with remorse, to kiss her feet, for beg her to forgive me. I was longing to do it. My breast was bursting. I never again thought of that moment without emotion. But what for, I thought. Won't I hate her even more tomorrow? Just because I kissed her feet today? As though I could give her any sort of happiness. As though I hadn't found out today for the 100th time what I'm really worth. As though I could prevent myself from torturing her. And isn't it much better for her to bear this humiliation as long as she lives? Because humiliation is purification. Because it causes the most corrosive, most painful awareness. He talks himself through it. And no, but let me ask a question now on my own behalf. What's better, cheap happiness or lofty suffering? Well, tell me, which of the two is better? And he goes home. At least he gave her lofty suffering, he says, and he may have. But it was unnecessary. And it is a way of finally closing himself off totally from the world. He wraps it up. It isn't literature. This is a punishment and an expiation. I swear this has no literary interest, because what novel needs is a hero? Whereas here I have collected, as if deliberately, all the features of an anti-hero. That's true. These notes are bound to produce an extremely unpleasant impression because we've all lost touch with life and we're all cripples to some degree. He is us. We've lost touch to such an extent that we feel a disgust for life as it is really lived and cannot bear to be reminded of it. He goes on in this vein and then ends. Talk about yourself and about your own miseries and your stinking hole, but don't you dare say all of us. But listen to me for a moment. I'm not trying to justify myself by saying all of us. As for me, all I did was carry to the limit what you haven't dared to push even halfway, taking your cowardice for reasonableness, thus making yourselves feel better. So I may still turn out to be more alive than you in the end. Come on, have another look at it. By today, we don't even know where real life is, what it is, or what it's called. Left alone without literature, we immediately become entangled and lost. We don't know what to join, what to keep up with, what to love, what to hate, what to respect, what to despise. We even find it painful to be men, real men of flesh and blood with our own private bodies. We're ashamed of it, and we long to turn ourselves into something hypothetical called the average man, the common man, the democratic man, the sensitive man, the businessman. We're stillborn, and for a time we've been brought into the world, and for a long time we've been brought into the world by parents who are dead themselves. And we like it better and better. We're developing a taste for it, so to speak. Soon we'll invent a way to be gotten by ideas altogether. No more parents. Test tube, cloning, genetic engineering. But that's enough. I've had enough of writing these notes from underground. Actually, the notes of this lover of paradoxes do not end here. He couldn't resist and went on writing. But we are of the opinion that one might just as well stop here. He is under the mouse hole in some large city, still ranting. However, now he's armed. Now he's armed. And very soon he's going to be armed with nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. He's loose. And he's still ranting, but he's now ranting through random acts of violence. Because the love was lost 150 years ago. And the answer, the only answer, is completely ignored. Thank you.